Cliff and I will be telling stories together, but I want to first kind of frame our conversation today about the seven principles. So unless you want to go as far as walking around with a lit chalice in your life, or wearing one around your neck, which some of us do, or as a pin on the lapel, it's really hard to sort of know or how to identify as a Unitarian Universalist. And one of the easiest ways, actually, at least in conversation, is to talk about the seven principles. So it can be convenient, especially if you're having a conversation with somebody outside of Unitarian Universalism who's trying to figure out, are you guys really a religion? And maybe inside of Unitarian Universalism, you're going like, are we really a religion? Right? If we're non-creedal, non-dogmatic, we don't have a set of beliefs that say you must believe this in order to identify as this, can we be a religion? And one of the things that's interesting, my colleague, James Ford, he's a UU minister, recently retired, but he's also a Zen priest. He says only the religions of the so-called West have some sort of creed as a test of membership. Right? That Christians and Muslims foremost in this regard, and only barely so for Jews. That no other world religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, has anything more than vaguely look like a creed, although sometimes when they encountered Christian missionaries, they began to sort of formulate ones in order to kind of reach that test. Oh, you're really a religion. So it's kind of interesting. So I want to give you a little history of our own seven principles. In 1960, just before the Unitarians and the Universalists, which were each a Christian denomination, right, heretical, so on the edges, they came together and they developed an original statement of purpose. And it's one that was good for about a quarter century, but didn't really sort of keep up with our needs. And so but when they put that together in the process of crafting in 1960, it was a heated discussion. It almost derailed the whole merger because there were lots of strong feelings about it. But then, because it was good enough for them, 25 years later, 1984, needed updating. That's where we got the set of principles that we now know that you'll find in your gray hymnal, and maybe when, you know, in other places around here. Hopefully you might have noticed a couple months ago I taped them on the doors to the kitchen just to get you some subliminal, right? Because I've heard from lots of you like, I don't know what the principles are. So I wanted to do a little bit of that. So Cliff and I are going to offer not a religious education class where you will be quizzed at the end of the service today. I do think it's important to know the principles, but I just had a meeting with David, actually, not one of our newest members, and I couldn't name all seven of them for it. And I was a little embarrassed, but I was like, okay, this is my truth. All right, which one's four? Which one's five? So I wanted to bring them alive for you in a different way than just telling you what they are and hoping that they might stick with you. So we're going to bring them alive for you through parable and true story. Cliff and I alternating our voices. So let us begin.
The first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And the story is the stranger's gift. There was once a village that had fallen on very hard times. The villagers had once been very happy, and their community had been famous for its hospitality and friendliness, and the warmth with which it welcomed strangers. But something had gone wrong in the village. People had begun to bicker with one another. Quarrels broke out for no apparent reason. Rivalry sprang up where there had once been friendship and trust. The chief of the village was very sad about this. He knew that the people would never be happy like this, but he could do nothing to restore the old times of harmony and peace. Strangers no longer wanted to come to the village. The people stopped caring for it. The village was falling into ruin. But it happened that one day a stranger came by. He approached the village like one with a mission, as though he already knew who he would find there. And very soon he met the village chief. He recognized the sad expression in his eyes, and the two were soon engaged in a serious conversation. The village chief told the stranger about his feelings of despair and his fears that soon the village would disintegrate. The stranger told the village chief that he might know of a way to redeem the lost village and restore it to a real community again. "Please tell me the secret," the village chief begged the stranger. "The secret is simple," the stranger said by way of reply. "The fact is, one of the villagers is actually the Messiah." The village chief could hardly believe what he was hearing, yet the stranger had an air of authority and about him that was irrefutable. The stranger left, but the village chief couldn't resist telling his closest friend what the stranger had told him. Soon the rumor ran through the village like wildfire. "One of us is the Messiah. Can you believe? Somewhere hidden among our member, the Messiah is living." Now, deep down, the villagers were a godly folk who wanted to be right in their community. The thought that the Messiah himself might be living among them incognito made them see things very differently. "Could it be the baker?" they wondered. "Or the old lady who breeds the chickens and sells the eggs? Perhaps it was old Granny Riley, whom the children were in the habit of taunting because of her scarred old face." The speculation went on and on and on. But the funny thing was that after the stranger's visit, things were never the same again. People began to treat each other with reverence. They lived like people who had a common purpose and who were seeking for something very precious together, never quite knowing whether the treasure was actually right in front of them. Before long, visitors began to come to the village just to be part of the happy, holy atmosphere that prevailed there. The stranger never came back. He didn't need to. The first principle is the inherent worth and dignity of every person.
The second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And our story is Dear Strangers at the Whole Foods Market by Deborah Green. And I offer it to you with a trigger warning. There's a story about suicide here. Dear strangers, I remember you. 10 months ago, when my cell phone rang with news of my father's suicide, you were walking into Whole Foods, prepared to go about your food shopping, just as I had done only minutes before. But I had already abandoned my full cart of groceries, and I stood in the entryway of the store. My brother was on the other end of the line. He was telling me my father was dead. He had taken his own life early that morning, and through his own sobs, I remember my brother kept saying, "I'm sorry, Deborah. I'm so sorry." I can't imagine how it must have felt for him to make that call. And as we hung up the phone, I started to cry and scream as my whole body trembled. This just couldn't be true. It couldn't be happening. Only moments before, I was filling my cart with groceries, going about my errands on a normal Monday morning. Only moments before, my life felt intact. Overwhelmed with emotions, I fell to the floor, my knees buckling under the weight of what I had just learned. And you, kind strangers, you were there. You could have kept on walking, ignoring my cries, but you didn't. You could have simply stopped and stared at my primal display of pain, but you didn't. No, instead you surrounded me as I yelled through my sobs, "My father killed himself, he killed himself, he's dead." And the question that has plagued me since that moment came to my lips in a scream, "Why?" I must have asked it over and over and over again. I remember the haze of emotions. One of you asked for my phone and asked who you should call. What was my password? You needed my husband's name as you searched through my contacts. I remember I could hear your words as you tried to reach my husband for me, leaving an urgent message for him to call me. I recall hearing you discuss among yourselves who would drive me home in my car and who would follow that person to bring them back to the store. You didn't even know one another, but it didn't seem to matter. You encountered me, a stranger, in the worst moment of my life, and you coalesced around me a common purpose to help. I remember one of you asking if you could pray for me and for my father. I must have said yes, and now I recall that Christian prayer being offered up to Jesus and for my Jewish father and me, and it still brings tears to my eyes and makes me smile. In my fog, I told you that I had a friend, Pam, who worked at Whole Foods, and one of you went in search of her. Thankfully, she was there that morning and you brought her to me. I remember the relief I felt seeing her face, familiar and warm. She took me to the back, comforting and caring for me until my husband could get to me. And I even recall as I sat with her, one of you sent back a gift card to Whole Foods. Though you didn't know me, you wanted to offer some little something to let me know that you would be thinking of me and holding me and my family in your thoughts and prayers. That gift card helped to feed my family when the idea of cooking was far beyond my emotional reach. I never saw you after that, but I know this to be true. If it were not for all of you, I might simply have gotten in my car and driven myself home. I wasn't thinking straight, if I was thinking at all. If it were not for you, I don't know what I would have done in those first raw moments of overwhelming shock, anguish, and grief, but I thank God every day I didn't have to find out. Your kindness, your compassion, your willingness to help a stranger in need have stayed with me until this day, and no matter how many times my mind takes me back to that horrible, life-altering moment, it is not all darkness. Because you reached out to help, you offered a ray of life, light in the bleakest moment I've ever endured. You may not remember it. You may not remember me. But I will never, ever forget you. And though you may never know it, I give thanks for your presence and humanity each and every day. The second principle is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
The third principle is acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. And the story is the golden ball. There was once a little boy who lived in a cottage with his parents. He often used to play out in the hills, and when it began to grow dark, he would go home. One day, as he was just returning home, the little boy lingered for a while at the door. Far away across the valley, he saw a beautiful golden ball. He was spellbound. What could it be, and who might own something so beautiful? That day, he made up his mind that he must make the journey to the other side of the valley to find his treasure. And so it happened that one morning he packed his little rucksack with some sandwiches and an apple and set off to make the journey to the other side of the valley. It took him all day. He had never been so far before, and it took him a lot longer than he had thought it would. By the time he arrived, it was late afternoon, and he was feeling very tired and hungry. Eventually, very close to the place he had hoped to find the golden ball, he came upon a little cottage with smoke curling up out of the chimney and roses climbing around the doorway. But there was no sign of the golden ball. Shyly, he knocked at the door. The family from the other side of the valley were happy to see him, though a little bit surprised if the truth were told. "You must be hungry," the mother exclaimed. "You're very welcome to eat with us." "Where do you come from?" the children asked excitedly, and the boy pointed across the valley to his own little home on the hill, now cloaked in darkness. "It's far too late for you to make the long journey home tonight," said the other mother. "We'll make you up a bed in the corner." And so the little boy from across the valley spent the night with his new friends. And as the evening shadow grew longer, they all sat around the kitchen fire while he told them about the golden ball that he had seen so often from his own home, and asked them where he might find it. "We've never seen a golden ball like that over here," they told him, puzzled. "But tomorrow morning, when the sun is rising, we'll show you our treasure." Little boy could hardly wait until the morning. When dawn arrived, the children took them to their doorway and pointed out their treasure. "Look over there," they said, pointing straight at his own home. "Over on the opposite hillside, can you see our golden ball?" And sure enough, there was a little golden ball to be seen shining back from his own bedroom window. "One day, we will go to the other side of the valley and find our golden ball," his new friends told him. The little boy smiled. The third principle is acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations.
The fourth principle is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And it comes to us from a retelling of the Swedish legend, What is Life? One lovely summer's day, around noon, there was a deep stillness all over the forest. The birds had tucked their heads under their wings, and everything was at rest. Then a bullfinch popped his head up and said, "What is life?" Everyone was struck by this profound question. A rose, just emerging from her bud and was opening one shy petal after another, rejoicing in newly discovered sunlight, she said, "Life is becoming." The butterfly was less philosophical. He blithely flew from one flower to another, snacking everywhere the delicious nectar. "Life is pure pleasure and sunshine," he announced. Down on the ground, an ant was laboring under the weight of a piece of straw 10 times his size. He said, "Life is nothing but toil and sweat and strain." There might have been quite an argument about the meaning of life had not a fine rain begun to fall. And the rain spoke, "Life consists of tears, nothing but tears." And high above the forest, an eagle swooped, making majestic curves in the sky. "Life," spoke the eagle, "is a constant striving upward." Night fell, and soon a man came staggering home from a party. "Life," he complained, "is a constant search for happiness and a string of disappointments." And after the long, dark night, at last, dawn came, rising on the eastern skyline. Just as I, the dawn, am the start of the new day, so life is the beginning of eternity. Our fourth principle is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning.
The fifth principle.
I think we're doing the offering.
Oh, we're doing the offering. Oh, okay. Now for the fifth principle. The right of conscience conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregation and in society at large. And the story is the parable of the weight of a snowflake. Tell me the weight of a snowflake, a sparrow asked a wild dove. Nothing more than nothing was the answer. In that case, I must tell a marvelous story, the sparrow said. I sat on a branch of a fir tree up close to the trunk when it began to snow. Not heavily, not a giant blizzard, no, just like in a dream without any violence. Since I didn't have anything better to do, I counted the snowflakes settling on my wings and needles of my branch. Their number was exactly 3,741,952. And you didn't even know a dove could count, right? When the next snowflake dropped onto the branch, nothing more than nothing, you say, the branch broke off. Having said that, the sparrow flew away. The dove thought about the story for a while and finally said to herself, "Perhaps there is only one voice lacking for peace to come into our world." Fifth principle is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregation and in society at large.
Not amplified now, it is. The sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Our story is a true one, as reported by James N. McCutcheon. The story is told about an incident that happened during the 30s in New York on one of the coldest days of the year. The world was in the grip of the Great Depression, and all over the city, the poor were close to starvation. It happened that the judge was sitting on the bench that day hearing a complaint against a woman who was charged with stealing a loaf of bread. She pleaded her daughter was sick, her grandchildren were starving, because her father had abandoned the family. But the shopkeeper, whose loaf had been stolen, refused to drop the charge. He insisted that an example be made of the poor woman as a deterrent to others. The judge sighed. He was most reluctant to pass judgment on the woman, yet he had no alternative. "I'm sorry," he turned to her, "but I can't make exceptions. The law is the law. I sentence you to a fine of $10, and if you can't pay, I must send you to jail for 10 days. The woman was brokenhearted, but even as he was passing the sentence, the judge was reaching into his own pocket for the money to pay the $10 fine. And then he took off his hat, tossed the $10 bill into it, and then addressed the crowd. "I'm also going to impose a fine of 50 cents on every person present here in this courtroom for living in a town where a person has to steal bread to save her grandchildren from starvation. Please collect the fines, Mr. Bailiff, in this hat and pass them across to the defendant." And so the accused went home that day from the court with $47.50. 50 cents of which was paid by the shame-faced grocery storekeeper who had brought the charge against her. And as she left the courtroom, the gathering of petty criminals and New York policemen gave the judge a standing ovation. Our sixth principle is the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
The seventh principle is respect for the independent web of all existence of which we are a part. And the story is by Kate Springer, and it was published in Time magazine in 2012. And it's called, the title is Soccer Ball Lost in Japan Tsunami Surfaces in Alaska. While roaming the beach on Alaska's barren, largely uninhabited Middleton Island, radar station technician David Baxter noticed a soccer ball floating off the shore. But it wasn't until he fished it out that Baxter realized how far the ball had traveled. Some 3,000 miles from its home in Japan, where a disastrous tsunami killed 19,000 people and poured the belongings of thousands of others into the ocean more than a year ago. That was 2011. According to the Associated Press, Baxter's Japanese wife, Yumi, was able to make out a name and translate a message inscribed on its surface. And soon enough, Yumi was on the phone with 16-year-old Masaki Murakami from the wave-ravaged Japanese town of Rikuzen-Takata, the International Business Times reports. It was a big surprise. "I've never imagined that my ball has reached Alaska," Murakami told the Japanese broadcaster NHK Media. "I've lost everything in the tsunami, so I'm delighted." The ball had been a going-away gift to Murakami when he transferred elementary schools in 2005. The Baxters planned to travel to Japan next month and return the soccer ball in person. They may be returning another treasure as well. A few weeks after finding the soccer ball, Baxter came across a volleyball with a similar inscription belonging to 19-year-old Shiori Sato from Japan's Iwate area. Over the past year, cleanup crews in the Pacific Northwest have been picking up plenty of debris washed ashore from the tsunami, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says the soccer ball is the first piece that can be returned to its owner. And there's a web reference if you want to read all that online. Seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part.
To bring to a close or bring full circle these seven principles, I want to speak to you about Parker Palmer and his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. In it, he names habits of the heart that he posits are necessary for the health of democracy and our nation as we know it. And I raise it up because that is one of our principles. How do we engage in democracy? Not big D democracy, but here among us with each other. How do we participate? And one of the habits of the heart that he thinks is necessary for a healthy democracy is something he calls holding tensions in life-giving ways. And I think this is the heart of spirituality as I know it, that life is paradoxical. It's full of contradictions. And here we are. We have to make sense of them. And that's very much my understanding of the seven principles, that though we could take each one of them on its own, and we often do, oh, I uphold the inherent worth and dignity of each individual, we are better off, we are richer, we are wiser, we are deeper humans when we engage the whole of them, recognizing each one as a part of a larger interdependent whole. So even if I were to ask you to just look at numbers 1 and 7, right? So 1, the inherent worth and dignity of each person. It focuses on the individual. And 7, the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. We're talking about this wide collective that we can see and that is beyond our seeing. We see that these two things are in tension with each other, right? Sometimes holding up the individual means pushing away the community, and sometimes holding up community means pushing away the individual. But there's a creative tension, and those five principles within those two are how we live into that tension. So we can look at 1 and 7 as bookends, James Ford, who I referenced before, talks about them as two sides of the same spiritual coin. You have on the front of your order of service a way of looking at the principles not in a linear fashion, 1 through 7, but in a circle, right? Where 1 and 7 are on the outside of the circle holding the center that 2 through 5, through 2 through 6 give us. You can also imagine some people do, I haven't been able to find the graphic for this, but a stone archway where on the right is the individual and on the left, I don't even know if I'm doing my slides right, on the left is community. And you know how a stone archway, the stones hold each other together without mortar? Those 5 in between hold that there and hold truth at its center. So that's true of the whole of the 7, but you can see that in individual principles too. So if the 4th principle talks about a search that's both free and responsible, right? And if we really look at that, that's contradictory. Free means I can do anything I want. Responsible means I'm accountable and my freedom is curtailed. So how do we live with that? Or in the 3rd, right, where I'm supposed to focus on my own spiritual growth, but also on yours. What happens if they come at odd angles with each other? Sometimes seeking justice makes it harder for us to have compassion. I've seen that in my own heart. I've seen that in some of your hearts after the election. Justice, compassion for folks who voted differently than you. How do we do that? And this is what I think is true about Unitarian Universalism. There is no easy set of beliefs that's handed to any of us. It asks of us to engage in that living tension. It asks for us to find new answers and to honor these principles and each other as we are a part of the interdependent web of all existence. May we do so well and with honor.